From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to this additional episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Bletchley Park and D-Day. With the opening of D-Day Interception Intelligence Invasion, the key role that Bletchley Park played in the success of the Normandy campaign is finally being told. Now, a new book written by our very own research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, adds even more depth to that story. Using previously classified documents, David casts the work of Bletchley Park in a new light, as not just a code-breaking establishment, but as a fully developed intelligence agency. This account reveals the true character of GCNCS's vital contribution to success in Normandy and, ultimately, Allied victory. Podcast producer Mark Cotton sat down with David to talk about the book, the process of writing military history, and the challenges of rewriting a well-known story in the light of new evidence.
David Kenyon and Bletchley Park is the dream ticket. A wonderful scholar and communicator writing about one of the world's most fascinating historical sites. That's not a bad introduction from Dan Snow there for your new book, is it, David?
It's not at all. I have taken a certain amount of good-natured ribbing about it, but it was very kind of him to do.
How much do you pay him?
I couldn't possibly say.
How's it feel after 2.5 years to be where we are today? So we're looking at your new book being released and we've got a new major exhibition. All of this is all based around D-Day and that's all you've lived for the last 2.5 years, isn't it?
Pretty much, yes. I mean, we've had other projects going on along the way, but I remember it was fairly soon after I joined Bletchley Park, 3 years ago-ish, when the D-Day project was first mentioned.
Yeah.
And the delivery date was always fairly set in concrete. We couldn't really do it next year.
No.
But I thought early on that I would like to write another book. I've written books in the past.
Yeah, this isn't your first book, we should say to people. You wrote one on...
I wrote one on First World War archaeology with a friend of mine.
Is that Digging the Trench?
Digging the Trenches. And then that was while I was doing my PhD. And then when I finished my PhD, that was on cavalry on the Western Front. And I wrote Horsemen in No Man's Land. My second book was basically a version of my PhD thesis with all the boring bits left out and some slightly more interesting bits put in.
In that one, you tell a story that people didn't really know.
That was the idea with that one, was to challenge some of the myths around the subject. And this is what I've tried to do with Bletchley Park and D-Day, is the idea that I don't believe there's a lot of point in writing a book if you're just going to say whatever all the other books say.
No.
You have to have something new to say about the story. And what was exciting about the D-Day project here, meaning both the book and the exhibition and all the other stuff we've done, is that it became clear fairly early on that there were new things to say and that the story hadn't really been covered in a lot of detail elsewhere.
Did you have a moment where you thought, I wonder if we've got material there? Did you have that moment, am I going to be able to write a book that tells a new story?
I did, but I was fortunate that we didn't make the final decision that I was going to write it until I knew I had a story. Because in a way, a lot of the preparatory research I was going to have to do anyway for the exhibition. And it was only after I'd done some of that work and I thought, yes, there's enough of a story here for a book, that we then firmed up the plan to do the book as well. So it wasn't a complete leap in the dark. But there was a point when the powers that be here at Bletchley had agreed to support and endorse the project and to give me the time to do it and everything else. And then at that point, you have a bit of a moment where you go, oh, blimey, it's real now. I've got to get on with this. What's been really nice is the organisation has been really supportive from the beginning.
Good.
And it's not about me. It's a Bletchley Park project, as much as it's a David Kenyon project. And so that works for both parties. You know, we can sell it in the shop. It promotes the site. It tells the story of the site. The thing about writing books is, before you set out on it, it sounds like a really brilliant idea. Mm. After you've done it, you go, I'm really glad I did that. But there are any number of points in the middle where you why on earth did I agree to do this?
What idiot decided to do this?
And the other thing, you know, if I had advice for aspiring historical writers out there, you start in the middle. And what I actually did was I took the chapters where I thought I had the most interesting things to say and perhaps the most revisionist, controversial things to say. And I wrote those chapters first. And that confirmed the decision one way or the other, whether there was actually a new story in it. And once you've done that, once you've done the really meaty bit in the middle, then it's a case of
topping and tailing it.
Topping and tailing it. I mean, it's more than topping and tailing it because those chapters have information in them as well. But you don't kind of go, right, page one, chapter one, you know. Actually, the writing process is much more scattergun than that. You write lumps of it and then you arrange those lumps into an order and then you make sense of it. So I wrote the heart of the story very early on. One of the ironies of it is that because I was aware that I was challenging some of the received perceptions about Bletchley, I put in a huge amount of detail because I wanted to make sure that I'd prove my point.
Yeah.
And those chapters then went out for peer review by other experts before I got the contract from the publishers. And they kind of came back and said, you don't need that much detail. We believe you. And so there's a whole lot of material, kind of the really technical stuff that was in those chapters, which isn't there anymore. The book's actually a chapter shorter than it would have been.
But that's the job of an editor.
And that's the job of an editor. And what we all hope that has achieved is it makes a book that is enjoyable, readable, tells a good story, and that anyone can read. I mean, the good example is talking about Lorenz and Colossus and the whole German teleprinter communications. The point about that is the intelligence benefit of that information. And we've talked about this in other podcasts. And the book is about the intelligence. But I initially wrote quite a long chapter that explained how Lorenz works and how Tiltman broke Lorenz.
Okay.
And when you've put a couple of mathematical equations in, you know you've gone too far.
Yeah.
So a lot of that went. And actually, that's not what the book is about. There's plenty of other books that deal with the technical matters of the cryptanalysis, which other people can read.
People can go back to the report on Tunney if they want to read all the mathematical equations.
Exactly. And there were several points where the editor said, the story was really bowling along, and then you've delved into all this detail. So the thing you have to do for these things to succeed is not be massively precious about what you've written. The risk is when you've sort of sweated your soul into something like this, that somebody comes along and covers it in red pen and says, you've got to chop this bit out and throw that bit away. It can be a bit of a blow when you first get the email and you look at the manuscript, it's in bits. But actually, it's all in a good cause. And if it makes a better book, that's what you want.
Anything creative, you should be able to see the bigger picture, shall we say. So you said you wanted to correct some of these misconceptions about Bletchley Park. What in particular?
Well, there are two main stories about Bletchley and D-Day. One is that people at Bletchley didn't know the invasion was happening.
Yep.
And this goes to a wider idea that Bletchley Park worked very much in isolation and that they were almost a sort of ivory tower where they got intercepted signals in and they studied them very intently and they didn't let their minds be clouded with information from anywhere else.
Yep.
It became clear fairly early in the research that actually the opposite was true. They were garnering as much information as they could from wherever they could find it to inform their understanding of the signals. And the second point is that while, you know, many of our living veterans, it's quite true, they didn't know about D-Day until they read it in the paper because they were very junior in the organisation and it wasn't their job to know about D-Day. But the people whose job it was absolutely knew about it and were working on it for a very long time.
You've been saying for quite a while now about the Western Front Committee. We mentioned it a couple of times in earlier podcasts last year, but our last episode really focused in on the work of the Western Front Committee. And I guess that's what's really helped with this book.
Very much so. And that kind of happened by accident as well, because one of the really crucial documents for this, or series of documents, is the minutes of the Western Front Committee. Yeah. And these are these guys who got together in October 1942, and every week they collated what they knew that was useful for an invasion. And those documents had only been released by GCHQ in the early 2000s, I think. So a lot of the previous books about Bletchley had not had a chance to look at them. I didn't know they existed, but we happened to have a copy in the archives here at Bletchley Park, and the archivist had got it out for our volunteers to digitise it. So it was lying on a table just down the corridor from my office. And what I tend to do when I walk through there is if the stuff come out of the archives, I always have a nose because I'm a nosy person. And I looked at this stuff and I went, hang on a minute, this is gold. And so once they'd scanned it, I got hold of both the physical copy and the scans and just was able to then go through it. And I created all sorts of lists and spreadsheets out of that, because you could actually tabulate the growth of the intelligence picture through that year and a half period. And that, I think, is really new. It also makes a second point about how Bletchley functioned, which I think has potentially been overlooked, which is the idea that all Bletchley did was generate ultra, was the famous messages that went to commanders and to Churchill and things. Actually, of all the messages they intercept, only about 10% ever become the classic ultra that everyone's familiar with. The other 90% are absorbed into Bletchley's brain in other ways. And you have all this story about the indexing, which I think is a really undervalued story. That all this information, snippet by snippet, is being very carefully recorded on these index cards. And there are millions of index cards.
I mean, I think this is, like you say, one of the misconceptions, because people think that every single one of those messages, it all ended up on the desk of Churchill. But it didn't, because the vast majority of the messages they're getting during the day, it might be a U-boat captain going off to a course and he wants to book a hotel room in three months' time.
I mean, the Hut 3 history talks about these piles that they sorted the messages into, which was kind of very urgent, slightly less urgent, important, and rubbish. Sometimes up to 40% of the stuff they're intercepting just is so garbled or partial that you can't understand it. Or even if you can understand it, as you say, the news in it is so mundane.
Yeah.
You don't need to tell Eisenhower that someone's gone on leave. Yeah.
But with those sort of messages, that's where traffic analysis comes in, isn't it?
Yes. They still have a value in the sense that you know that people are communicating with them. And sometimes there's a famous case where an application for leave from an officer in Russia has to be approved by von Rundstedt in France. And that's the first hint that Bletchley get that his whole Panzer division is about to move to France. So you can't overlook these things. You describe them as trivial, but there is a lot of stuff that you don't need to tell Bletchley's customers straight away. It just goes into the pot of all the things that Bletchley knows and helps to inform the bigger picture. And the other thing that is a natural consequence of that is, at the start of the war, there was a lot of pressure on Bletchley from the service ministries and elsewhere saying, it's not your job to do intelligence, it's your job to do decryption, and we do the intelligence. The Air Ministry in particular was very adamant about this. But by 1944, you've got to a point where people have realised that you can't just do decryption, you have to do intelligence, because it's a feedback loop. In order to understand the traffic, you have to analyse it. And so by D-Day, Bletchley is much more of a rounded intelligence agency. It's not just a decryption and translation service. And that, again, I think, has not been fully appreciated in the past. But like many of these things, once you think about it, you go, well, surely that's obvious.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, Bletchley is not able to listen to everything at any point in the war. Their resources are always stretched, and they always have to choose to listen to only bits of enemy communications. And in order to choose which bits you need to listen to, you need to know what your customers want. You need to know what the Army and the Navy are planning so that you can feed them the relevant information.
Yeah.
So all of those kind of feedback loops that exist everywhere mean that Bletchley is much more integrated, if you like, with the whole war effort than has been previously suggested, I think.
And D-Day is the prime example of that, isn't it?
D-Day is the prime example of that because it's such a large operation. It's an unprecedentedly large operation. It's the biggest thing that happens in World War II in many ways, on the Western Front, certainly. And so Bletchley's involvement in it is the biggest project they undertake. And it happens at a point in the war when their organisation is reaching its maturity.
Mm.
So if you want to see Bletchley at its most efficient and effective, I mean, it does get a little bit bigger by the spring of 1945. The maximum staff numbers is in January 45. But certainly if you're looking at the war in the West, D-Day is kind of the peak. I was saying before about how when you start to make these points that you feel anew, there is a little bit of hesitation about it. You feel a bit of trepidation because you want to know that you've proved your point, and you also know that even if you have proved your point, some people will resent the fact that you've proved them wrong. And so I was very relieved when I got the peer review feedback, because it's published with Yale, who are an academic press. And what that means is, before they publish the book, they send it to other experts in the field, other academics who will peer review it, and they will say, yes, this book is any good or not. And the feedback I got was very encouraging, because people said, yes, you've got a good point, you've not missed. Because the other worry is that there's some enormous thing that's been written that I've not noticed that proves me completely wrong. But then subsequently, one of the books that was the foundation for my book is Ralph Bennett's book. Ralph Bennett worked in Hut 3. He wrote a lot of the ultra messages. But then when they were declassified in 1977, he went and read them all again. And he wrote his book on the basis of that information. And it's a brilliant book. And I couldn't have written my book without his, because he read 45,000 messages and footnoted them all. It meant I didn't have to.
Exactly.
Which is very helpful. But because of the limited amount of information he had access to, some of the conclusions he draws are now out of date because of new releases. So I'm polite about him, but not uncritical of him. I then discovered when I got an email from Yale that one of the former directors of the publishers was his son.
Oh.
So I got an email from another Mr. Bennett saying, really enjoyed your book. And I thought, oh, blimey.
You've passed the test then for that.
Well, I hope so. And he made the point very magnanimously. He said, you know, history moves on, you know. I mean, my book in 50 years will be out of date, I hope, because research will have moved forward. People will understand more about it.
Well, when he wrote his book in 1979, no one even knew about Lorentz, did they? The Enigma story was out, but no one knew about Colossus and Lorentz.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things he talks about in there, he talks about particularly difficult ciphers hitherto unbroken. But that's as far as he goes, because the whole Lorentz Colossus story...
Was he alluding to them in
that? He was alluding to them, but... He never explicitly says that there's these two different channels of information. And since the Lorentz story has been declassified and we have the general report on Tunney and all the rest of it and the history of the fish section and things, there's a much clearer picture of the role that the different cipher systems played in the intelligence picture. It's not all about Enigma by any means.
No.
There's all the fish stuff. You've also got all the Japanese diplomatic stuff, which we talk about in the exhibition as well as in the book. And you start to see that it's a multi-source process. And that just doesn't apply to D-Day. One of the things that people, when they talk about Bletchley, they tend to talk about Enigma. And you hear this phrase over and over from journalists where they say, Bletchley Park broke the Enigma code. In the first place, Enigma, it's a cipher, not a code, but it's not even one code. It's a system that is changed every 24 hours. And it has 200 different networks. And there are 25 different varieties of Enigma machine. But then it's not just about Enigma. It's about Lorentz. It's about minor codes. It's about Air Force codes. It's about Japanese, Italian, Hungarian, Romanian, French. You know, the diversity of the work that went on here is astonishing. And people tend to forget about all that. And they just narrow down on the one famous machine and the one famous man in the form of Turing and forget about all the rest. I talk about Japanese diplomatic traffic in there, but the challenge for us going forward as well is to look at the picture in the Pacific and the anti-Japanese effort that went on here. Because, you know, we talk about the peak of numbers of Bletchley being in January 1945. A huge proportion of those people by that point are working on Japanese systems. And it's a huge part of the work, but it's not a story that gets told very often.
I have the finished article in my hand. What's the most satisfying thing for you when you hold that in your hand?
It applies to not just this book, but the previous books I wrote. If you're a historian, and particularly I'm a military historian, so I deal with, well, with a lot of death. And when you talk about particularly the 20th century and the world wars, you are talking to a certain extent about remembrance.
Yep.
And I think my job as a historian, in the bigger sort of commemorative sense, is to try and tell these people's stories as accurately as you can. My previous work on the First World War, there's a lot of mythology around the First World War, and the participants in the war are portrayed in a very particular way quite often. And I don't think that that necessarily does them justice. And the same is true for the Second World War. Participants in wars are very often portrayed as victims who don't have any agency in themselves, that they're just sort of carried along in the tide of events. Actually, these are all real people who did their jobs and, you know, they were set certain tasks, often very difficult, dangerous tasks, and they got on with them. And the way that these people are best remembered is accurately. And so anytime you can get into the story of what people were doing and why they were successful in these terrible circumstances, I think that's kind of an act of healthy remembrance in its own right.
Yeah, it's thanking them for their service.
It's thanking them for their service in that way. And the same applies a little bit to Bletchley, that there is a huge, again, body of myth around Bletchley. And in many cases, it portrays the people here as having this kind of almost like this golden existence. It was all about, you know, rounders and pipe smoking and crosswords. Actually, work at Bletchley was war work, the same as a war work, the length and breadth of Britain. And a lot of it was very, very dull. It was on night shifts. It was miserable.
Yeah.
The food wasn't great. You know, people were not told what they were doing. And so would I have liked to work at Bletchley Park? Probably not. It was probably a grinding misery.
Yeah.
But that's not saying that the place wasn't significant or that what was done here wasn't important. I just think the danger is that it gets dressed up, you know, by books and movies as this kind of glamorous life. And as I say, the best way to remember the work of the people here is firstly to be honest about what it was like for them. Mm. But secondly, the other thing that happens with Bletchley as well is people get very engaged in process. You know, how do you break a code? How does an Enigma machine work? How does whatever? And actually, I use the phrase in the book, no one would care about Bletchley Park if the Germans were encrypting their laundry lists. We care about this because it was significant to the outcome of the war. And so if you spend all your time talking about process or, you know, what was the food like or what was it like to be at Bletchley Park, and you never say why it matters, then you've kind of missed the point. And I think both the exhibition and what I tried to do in the book was say, you know, we're all employed here with this place as a visitor attraction because it did significant things for the outcome of the war. And the individuals here who were working, their work didn't just exist in a vacuum. It had a direct influence on whether other people, you know, soldiers on the battlefield lived or died, whether they won or lost. And making that connection really explicit, you know, if they can read this message in Buckinghamshire about these Germans in France, it means that these soldiers attacking those Germans have a better chance. And that direct connection perhaps isn't explained as explicitly as it should be quite often.
And do you think you've done that?
I hope so. I hope so. One of the things that I was asked by the publisher, actually, which initially a little bit of a challenge, but I think improves the book, is I'd written it quite academically and a little bit perhaps impersonally to start with. But they came in and said, you know, put more people in. And I went back and I found a series of individuals who I could then weave into the narrative to bring that human element to it. And they're not all employees of Bletchley Park. A couple of them are Germans. But what it does is it gives you that link between individual activity and experience and the great events of the day. And I think that's really important. You've got to have people in the story.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.